My name is Brenno de Winter. We've got a full hour ahead talking about digital rights, activism, and what is going down in the world we live in, because sometimes things take a turn for the worse, and you think you're free on the internet, but in essence you're not that free. One of the projects on the internet to help us out to achieve internet freedom is the Tor project. And Tor is one of the very important projects, and one of the leads is Roger Dingeldyne. And earlier this evening, I had a conversation with him. Roger Dingeldyne, you're with the Tor project. It's something got to do with anonymity. Can you explain what your project does?
We're a nonprofit in the U.S., and we write software to help people on the on the internet be safe. So it's a program that you can get and install on your computer, and the idea is that it builds a path through several volunteer relays on the internet to provide anonymity. So somebody watching your network connection doesn't learn which web pages you're going to, and somebody running the websites can't figure out who you are or where you're coming from.
Why would I want to do that? You know, I've got nothing to hide.
There are a lot of different reasons for people who use Tor. And part of the value of Tor, part of the security of Tor, is the diverse set of users. So we have a lot of people in the Arab Spring in the Middle East who are using it because they want to get around censorship. But we also have ordinary people in the U.S. and Europe and other places who read about governments losing big databases, and they think, maybe I want to be safer online. We also have corporations who are using it to check out the competition without letting them know who's looking at them. And we've got governments and law enforcement and military. There are a lot of different organizations out there who want to be safe or anonymous or private or secure online, and they all have something different that they're thinking about.
So it's not all that, and of course criminals, because if you've got good use, you also have got bad use.
At this point, we've got hundreds of thousands of people using Tor every day, so we look like a generic cross-section of the internet. So there are bad people on the internet, and some of them use Tor.
Yeah. Now, I can imagine that some governments, especially you mentioned the Arab Spring, those governments must hate your guts.
I'm not sure I'd go that far. It's hard for us to tell what's going on in their minds. All we can see is the effect that they have in terms of the technical censorship of the internet there. So we did a talk last night here about the variety of approaches that various governments and corporations have used for trying to block connections to the Tor network. So Tor, we originally focused on it as an anonymity system, meaning there are a bunch of volunteers running relays out there, and we need more to make the network faster. But of course you can reach the Tor network. But the problem that we encountered a few years after we started was some countries try to prevent their entire set of population from reaching the Tor network. And maybe it's a great anonymity system, but if you can't get to it, then it can't work for you.
What countries didn't do such a thing?
Well, it started out with a bunch of governments in the Middle East and also governments like Thailand who started blocking our website. And their reasoning was, if we prevent our citizens from learning about this tool or having it be easy to download, then they'll never bother learning about it. They'll never end up using it. And that didn't work for them because there are a lot of people in all of these countries who are teaching everybody about all of the options and teaching people how to get around the censorship.
Okay, because we spoke to a dissident from Turkey, and he was thankful to the government because now more people than you would expect know how to use a VPN.
Yeah, we certainly see that over and over in terms of, for example, China periodically blocks Google search, or at least they did back before Google decided to leave China. And every time China blocks Google, a bunch of people in China learn how to get around censorship. And then they unblock it because they're doing it as sort of a show of force to remind people who's in charge there. And every time they do it, they teach another round of people how to get around the censorship.
So basically, it just doesn't work.
the more you try to crack down, the more people want to talk. And especially in countries like Iran, where, I mean, they have the highest per capita blogger population of any country. They had a lot of people using the internet, and now they're trying to censor them. That's not going to work.
Okay, now I'm from the Netherlands. Some people here are from Germany, several of them from the United States. How are those governments responding to Tor?
We actually get some funding from the U.S. government and from some European governments because they want tools like this to work and to be better. Some of them look at it as we want to provide freedom to other countries around the world, but some of them look at it as we need this tool for our people to be able to, for example, we get funding from the U.S. Naval Research Lab, and they're looking at it as a tool to let U.S. government people be able to be safe online. So that's one answer. Many of them like it. Another answer is some people are nervous about internet freedom, and it's not just the government of Syria that's concerned.
Now, can you give some couple of examples of people who are nervous and how they react?
What do you mean by that?
Well, in the Netherlands, we had a case of a boy. His computer was confiscated because he supposedly was surfing for child pornography. Turned out not to be the case, but somebody else did. And the Dutch government didn't understand how it worked. So he was, for a year, he was in a lot of trouble. And then finally, they got around and understood that somebody else might be doing something that is illegal, not being him, using an anonymity network. And the Dutch government is not too much a fan of Tor.
I talk to a lot of law enforcement in various countries, and a lot of these conversations start out with them saying, my job is hard and it's your fault.
Yes.
And part of what I need to teach them is, yes, their job is hard, but it's not because of me that there are bad people on the internet. If you take Tor away from the internet, the bad people are still going to be there, and law enforcement is still going to have a heck of a time trying to track them down. So the best case scenario after I sit down and do a training for a few hours is that they come out saying, my job is hard, but I know it's not your fault. I know it's not because of you that my job is hard.
So basically talking to them helps?
So far, yes. Every time I do a talk to the FBI in the U.S. these days, there's an FBI agent who comes up to me afterwards and says, I use Tor every day for my job. Thank you. And they actually help me refine the arguments for the law enforcement who haven't figured out how Tor fits into things. One of the best examples that I heard was an FBI person who said, I have 48 hours and I have 20 leads. If you can help me understand which of these is not going to work so I can focus on the ones that might work, I can do my job better. So the more I can teach them about why Tor, looking at a Tor relay, is not going to help them find whoever they're looking for, whether it's a good person or a bad person, depending on which government you're talking about, the more they can do their job.
It's organized like this, that you have you're entering the Tor network, get through a few hops, different hops, and then you have an exit node where you then enter the page where you want to go. What kind of people are running this exit nodes? Because they are actually giving away their IP address to everybody in the world, which can end up in legal problems perhaps also.
Yeah, we have 2,000 or 3,000 people running relays right now. And this is still the same, it's the same Tor software. You can use it as a client or a relay. So all you have to do is install Tor and then click the box saying, I want to help internet freedom, or I want to help relay traffic for other people. There are a wide variety of people who run relays. There's a small group of people who run lots of fast relays, and they do it because they want to maintain human rights and civil liberties. They're looking around at all the things happening in the world, and they say, I have bandwidth that I can contribute to this, and I want to make the world a better place. Especially starting with the protests in Egypt last January, a lot of people started to realize this is something that I can contribute to and I can actually make a difference. I can allow people in Egypt, people in Iran, people in Syria, people in Germany, people in the Netherlands, whoever needs internet freedom, to be able to communicate safely with whatever they need to do.
And this is quite easy. So if anybody who is listening now is thinking, I want to help, to I have some bandwidth, How should they proceed?
Yeah, it depends on which operating system you have, but we have packages for basically every operating system. So technically, it's pretty easy to set up. If you're at home, the biggest problem you're going to have is what's called port forwarding, because you will run the Tor software on a computer, and you probably have some Linksys router or something like that that doesn't let connections from the internet reach into your computers. And most people who've set up BitTorrent have set up port forwarding for it. So there are a lot of people out there who've learned how to do it. And in a lot of cases, it automatically works. Mm-hmm. Tor is working on more ways of having it automatically just magically be able to configure and work.
Last question. For the next 6 months, what do you envision to do?
There are a lot of things we need to work on. We've been working on the research side of how do you measure anonymity and how do you improve anonymity. There's also the outreach side. There are a lot of people out there who need to learn more about circumvention and anonymity tools. And part of what we need to do is train more people to go out and train more people, because I can't be the person who teaches everybody. One of the problems we've been working on very recently, there are a lot of corporations in America and Europe who are selling censorship tools and surveillance tools to dictators around the world. And these censorship and surveillance tools have built-in attacks on Tor. So we need to keep up with the arms race there, where Cisco, for example, sells a product that claims to be able to censor Tor. We need to figure out exactly how they're doing it and how we can change the Tor protocol so their censorship doesn't work anymore.
Roger, you do a very, very good job. Thank you so much for explaining all this.
Thank you.
Behind enemy lines.
Der 28. Chaos Communication Kongress vom 27. bis zum 30. Dezember 2011 im Berliner Kongresszentrum.
You're back at the Berliner Kongresszentrum, where the 28C3 is taking place. I'm sitting across the table from Eric Josephson and, of course, my beautiful and always charming boss, Frederik Meyer, who sometimes also pops in a couple of questions. Eric.
Yes.
Who are you and what are you doing?
I'm advisor to the Green Group on Internet Policies in the European Parliament.
Yes, and this morning you were very, very angry.
Oh, I've been very angry for a long time.
Yes, because you're angry about the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement.
Yeah.
Or the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. Anyhow, it's an trade agreement that actually is some kind of a punishment treaty for cloning medicine, copying music, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's called a trade agreement, but it's really not about trade. It's about intellectual property. Or if you break that down, it's about copyright, it's about patents, trademarks, and the laws that follows with that. And it basically makes enforcement of these laws harmonized on a higher level than today in between the countries that are signatories to this agreement.
Yes. Now, yesterday on the show, we've been talking about it, but one of the interesting things, of course, is that you want... The negotiation was behind closed doors. That's not okay, but that's the reality now. Then, of course, there must be some opinion that is given by the lawyers or the people that know to the European Commission.
Yeah.
Is that public?
Well, it's actually unclear, or it was unclear just until the days before Christmas about this transparency or how the institutions or the European Parliament was dealing with the discussion on whether to say yes or no to ACTA.
But
and it has been I've followed this before also in the Swedish Parliament when there were negotiations in one of the committees in the Swedish Parliament that was also held in secret, and the members of the Swedish Parliament that were talking about it, they could not... show the documents to anybody outside this committee, and the negotiations have been secret, and when parliaments have been dealing with it, it has also been secret.
But that's strange, because the opinion basically says, like, this is something we can do, or this is something we can't do, this will violate human rights, this won't violate human rights. What was the line of reasoning not to open at first the opinion?
Yes. No, the argument is built on the traditional way you think about trade agreements. And trade agreements are normally then negotiated in secret. And this becomes obviously a contradiction, since this since ACTA contains much more than trade issues. It's about changing law, yeah, even criminal law.
But those are two arguments, and they're always the same. One is it's for political reasons, like we want to be able to deal with diplomacy, and that is always done in secret.
Yeah.
And the other one is, you know, positions could be harmed. But now this morning you showed me a third reason, and that was kind of interesting.
Yes. So... when the Parliament started to deal with this agreement after, or just before the summer break, the committees responsible in the Parliament asked the legal service of the Parliament for their opinion. And then the legal service argued that this their opinion on ACTA should be confidential. And for some reason, the MEPs, the politicians involved in this, accepted the argument that it should be confidential.
That's clear, but what was the argument?
The most strange argument they used was that they said that disclosure of this document, of the opinion of the legal service, would seriously undermine the institution's decision-making process.
So the legal reasoning might influence the ultimate decision.
They said that the arguments the legal service has found for saying yes or no to ACTA cannot be made public, because that would harm the decision-making process of the Parliament.
So basically they're saying, if you get our advice, that's strange. That's very strange, because normally what you would expect is that such an advice is open. So, you know, like, they say yes, they say no, they say maybe, and you know what you're up against.
Well, yes, I would say that normally the decision-making process in a democracy is taking place in public. That's why you have parliaments, where you discuss whether things should go the one way or the other, and you do that in public, and you measure the arguments against each other and say you find the arguments reasonable or not, and you do this in public. But the legal service said We cannot do this in public because that would harm the institution's decision-making process.
So here we have a treaty, let me rephrase it, that is being negotiated in secret. We still don't know exactly what the treaty looks like.
We know the text.
But we don't know how they interpret it.
Exactly.
In Europe, they say, like, this is a binding treaty. And in the US, they say, like, we cherry pick.
There are many strange things about ACTA, and one of the things is that for the US, it is not binding, and it cannot be binding under US law because ACTA will then force the US to change its law, and any change in the US law has to go through the through Congress, and this is not going through Congress; it's just going through an executive agreement with the under the president's authority. So it's not binding on the U.S., and the U.S. Gets away with binding other countries to this agreement without binding itself.
You could draw a parallel with flying to the United States. In the past, we had these flying agreements where American carriers could land on basically all European airports. And then they said, like, yeah, you can land on any U.S. airport, but you cannot fly ahead while... In the US airlines can fly, for instance, into Amsterdam and then take a continuing flight to Rome.
I don't know that much about that case, but it's clear that
it's one-sided.
Yes, extremely one-sided.
That's interesting.
The advantages of having other countries to pay more for the cost, the societal cost of having. Patent rights enforced in a much harsher way, to have stronger copyright enforcement. That cost, the U.S. can choose to have it or not.
What is the current state right now with ACTA? The Netherlands basically have kind of sort of said yes. What have other countries done?
There's one part of ACTA that's about criminal sanctions. And criminal sanctions have to be decided by member states in the European Union. It's still something that each member state has the competence or authority to decide for itself. So the criminal sanctions part of ACTA has to be ratified by each party to ACTA, but by each member state in Netherlands or in Sweden. The other part, the major part of ACTA, can then be signed by the Council. For the overall agreement to be valid, the European Parliament has to say yes or no, or more formally, they have to give or withhold consent. And what will happen now after Christmas is that a number of committees in the European Parliament will talk about ACTA and decide whether the Parliament should say yes or no, and the vote will come up later, maybe in April or something.
Okay, if I were a member of parliament, I would be in one of those commissions. I would ask, okay, what do we get out of ACTA? What's in it for me? Why would I care? Why would I want to say yes?
There are not that many good arguments for saying yes. There are many stronger arguments for saying no. It depends a bit on how you argue. Which political party you are a member of. For the Greens, fundamental rights is extremely important. And we have commissioned studies from external experts saying that ACTA is in breach of fundamental rights. So for us, it's clear that ACTA must be rejected, or at least it has to be tested by this.
Help me understand why somebody wants to say yes. Why do the Christian Democrats favor ACTA? Because they're one of the parties that are in favor, I understood.
I think they are stuck in the ideological position that more and stronger intellectual property rights automatically means more jobs or more better competitive advantage for Europe, while in fact it might actually be the other way around. There's very little fact supporting that ideological position. to say that stronger intellectual property rights will actually give more jobs and more more innovation. But they believe that and are maybe less interested in facts than other parties.
Three final questions. One, can ACTA still be stopped?
Yes.
Will you do that?
Yes.
And are you having a good time at CCC?
No. I'm having a great time here at CCC. It's great to be here to talk about my favorite subject, ACTA, and to listen to all the lectures and meet all the people here that also care about these things. And I think we can, if we work together, we can actually stop ACTA.
Erik Josephson, thank you so much for talking to us, and you're still listening to 88.5 FM Tupai Radio.
So our next interview guest was here like an hour ago, Sigparis Fidanar from the Alternative Informatics Association of Turkey. He's living in Istanbul, and this organization is one of many organizations that oppose the ongoing efforts for state-controlled internet in Turkey. They see that the problem with media control in Turkey and in Europe also are increasingly becoming part of a global problem. The governments are working on their own view of a secure internet, and we have to articulate and suggest an alternative. So now you can. The talk was really very, very good. He gave like 2 days ago, so I invited him for the interview, which you can listen now. The talk was really very, very good. He gave like 2 days ago, so I invited in. I've heard your talk here on the 28th Chaos Communication Congress, and you told that you managed it to make a demonstration with like 60,000 person in Istanbul, I think it
yeah.
was. So how did you manage this for a topic like internet, which is, I think, oh, you saw the demonstration here before, yeah. which was perhaps 100 persons. How did you manage to get like 60,000 people on the street?
It's hard to say that we managed or some person planned and managed to do this, because maybe it was the government who managed to generate such enormous reaction by offering some mandatory filter for the internet. After a few years after introducing a censorship law, which already triggered some reaction. And as a result, it was totally spontaneous. Someone opened up Facebook event, and there came 600,000 people on that event. Of course, Facebook thought it was a bot, but it was not. In the end, the people that opened the Facebook page found themselves in a position to organize an event, and they tried to find the right people to form an organizing team. And as a result, the demonstration was held in several cities, most of them hundreds of people in tens of cities, and especially in Istanbul, the İstiklal Street was full of people, and we estimated like 60,000.
What does that mean? You say they filter the internet traffic. How should I see that? How do you notice that? Because in the Netherlands and for you in Germany, we don't have filters really.
In fact, before the filter, there was this 5651 law of censorship that was to block IPs and DNSs of websites based on 8 categories, including obscenity, crimes against Atatürk, etc., various things. And using this law, they had blocked, for example, WordPress, based on just a single blog post there, or they blocked YouTube, of YouTube, based on just a single video.
And just to explain, WordPress is of course a website where you can open up your own blog. They've got thousands of blogs there, and because one offended the Turkish government,
yeah,
you were not allowed to go there at all.
Yeah, I think they did this like a national attitude. So we don't need your video technology. We don't need your blogs. We Turkish people can live on their own, etc. And it was also used, this law was also used to censor alternative media, political opposition. So there was already a discussion and opposition in terms of censorship. And what they brought was a filter that they said they was offering the filter as a service. If you have a family you want to protect, as the father, of course, or you have children, you are afraid that will become, you can use this filter for free to have a limited internet. We may as well call Turkey Wide Web. So this is the service they are offering.
Are you also in the movement it's for the free internet or for the uncensored internet? Do you also are you also facing problems like legal problems or people getting into prison or something like this?
In fact, against the filter, it has of course affects people fear in general. So it has an effect, but not directly. We cannot say that many bloggers in prison or...
Okay, right. Yeah.
But it may happen sometime.
Where do you live?
In Istanbul.
Now you're here talking about this. There is censorship in your country.
Yeah.
Are you safe to return to Turkey now?
Well, I depend on people who know me. So,
do you think, all these demonstrations, lots of people on the street, did it already have an impact? Did it started some discussions?
The Internet Freedom event, the march, was, I think, like a single shot event. It was enormous, but it doesn't seem to continue because other political affairs. Other agendas come.
So but within the government, it has started some kind of discussions, or like is there?
Well,
some
of course, it had an effect. The effect was that we got a second decision, in which something important is that the standard profile is removed from the decision. Standard profile was. The profile that you were to choose if you don't want a filter. But we were suspicious because it had a name. So we was against it. We thought it was mandatory. It should not be mandatory. So it was remote. So in the last decision that is deployed, you can choose a family profile, you can choose child profile, or you can go on using... with the previous censorship law.
Okay, so there are always ways going around this IP blocking and stuff, or DNS blocking. Are there, people know how to manage this? Like, for example, in China, I think lots of people are using, VPN, VPN, virtual private networks to and connect somewhere outside of China to the internet then?
Yeah, the blocking... that's introduced also has an effect of making people aware of the methods they can use. So I can tell that after a few years, millions of people, maybe most of the population, has learned to change DNS.
Oh.
So, and what DNS are they using then? Regular, the Google DNS or whatever?
In fact, it's not. It's more of a practical know-how, and they just search for a DNS and they use whatever they find usually.
And other tools, do they also use?
Web proxies are used, but in this filter decision. Web proxies are also being filtered. Of course, if you choose a filter, we are gaining knowledge, we are gaining experience, and especially we have to know more technical tools, for example, like secure communication, etc.
That people are educating themselves.
Yeah.
So, to round up, we can say that Turkey has a lot of censorship, and the main effect is that many people now teach themselves how to get around that censorship,
yeah.
So it doesn't work. I wish you a very safe and trusted way home, and I hope that you will continue your tremendous good work. In the studio now is Maarten van Ewijk. Maarten is present here as a technology geek and understander of technology. And you had discovered a revelation, a new way of calculating with computers. What was this all about?
Well, the lecture was actually about the coming war on general computation, and it was really a revelation for me because, like most of us, we believe that the war against the copyright lobby was the only war going on and probably some sort of a end game or the last war we had to fight against censorship or oppressive technology and stuff like that. But the thing is,
and sorry to interrupt, but that's exactly, of course, what whole ECTA is about and what we all worry about.
Yeah, well, the thing is, the ECTA and the SOPA stuff is probably the first war, the first skirmish in a long line of battles.
Are you saying it's getting even worse?
Well, the battlefield will get bigger, but it's probably getting worse too because the corporations and organizations who are going to work against our freedoms are going to be bigger than what we have seen to date, because the copyright industry isn't nearly as big as the pharmaceutical industry or the automakers, the car makers and the plane builders and stuff like that.
Why would a car maker, a plane maker or a pharmaceutical institution work against me as a civilian?
Well, the thing is, a car is no longer a car. A car is now a computer you transport yourself with. Nearly all of the functions of a car have been taken over by some sort of computerized piece of technology.
An appliance?
Well, yeah, it is an appliance in some sort, but there's really no way you can make a computer an appliance. If a computer is constructed in a way to execute any program, there's really no way to make an appliance of it. So the closest possible thing you can do with a car would be making it a computer preloaded with spyware and rootkits to keep the user or the driver from executing its own or her own code or program.
Do you really think that's going to happen, that they would preload something with spyware?
It is already happening. The current generation of cars already has authentication methods and cryptography modules to stop you from loading new firmware into the engine, because lots of people were tuning their car engines in a way which was known as chip tuning by just loading a new firmware into the car engine and gaining like 50 horsepower or maybe 20 horsepower depending on the engine. And this of course wears out the engine much faster. What you win on the one end, you lose on the other. So the lifetime of the car shortens. And, the car makers weren't that happy with it, because if the car breaks, they have to provide you with new parts if it happens within a certain period.
But can't you then change the rules? I mean, what's the point of putting spyware and keeping track of people? You know, it would be kind of strange if you have a computer that you would keep track of somebody.
I don't really understand your question in this relation to cars.
Well, you say like, okay, load it with spyware, but then you have to read it out and you have to do all sorts of stuff to watch people. Do you really want to do that?
Well, of course, we're hackers. We don't.
No, we
think that's not the way technology should be designed. But these corporations who are pursuing a wish in which they try to make appliances instead of general purpose computers, they will keep preloading these things with spyware and rootkits.
Okay, now you're saying that in the beginning of a whole war, what will that war look like? A huge battlefield, you said. That's kind of creepy all.
Well, that's hacker talk, of course. The battlefield will be more tracking software, more hacking devices, and just like the DRM schemes are being broken right now for liberating your music files if some sort of a music service goes down. We're going to see more of this stuff with cars and radios and, well, pretty much anything, because anything is becoming a computer these days.
That's an interesting observation, and indeed a little bit eye-opening, as you would say. Thank you so much for answering these questions. We are running towards the end of the show, and we've got another guest that we had on the broadcast yesterday as well, and that's Jordi. Jordi, you've been observing a different way of dealing with appliances.
Yes, I've watched a lecture about the unsafety type for printers, the multifunctional printers. A lot of people know that printers are in fact also computers. But because they don't know they are really just normal computers, they just put them anywhere next to the CFO's computer, like that. But in fact, that they are very easy to hack because there is no kind of security for those printers.
So, I could read perhaps the documents the CFO or the CEO of whatever FO is printing.
Yeah, very easy, actually.
Just how?
No, well, it's some kind of printers. They do a firmware update with just a normal file, like a PDF or, in this case, a PostScript file. When you read those firmware PostScript files, you can read out how the printer works. But you can also make your own firmware. And just by printing the file, you're sending the file to the printer, you can update the firmware of the printer.
Are you saying that if I can print to a printer, I can update the firmware and do whatever I want?
Yes.
That's a revelation as well.
Yeah. It's a very scary thing because, well, not a lot of people know this.
I wonder how many IT departments in the world have ever updated their printer firmware voluntarily.
Not a lot, I guess. The normal firmware is about, well, 5 years old now. So it's full of bugs and it's not being updated. So the bugs won't be patched.
That's an interesting end of the show, I have to admit. Thank you for all the studio guests for being here and everybody who contributed to it. And I wish you a guten Rutsch ins neue Jahr.
Yeah.